Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today, I talk with Brad Flowers, founding partner of Bullhorn Creative in Lexington, Kentucky. We talk about building an agency and how early on not having a marketing background was an advantage. Bullhorn's process for working on naming projects. Knowing when a client is the right fit for your culture and more, all right after this. We all secretly, and some of us openly, know that we have a deep love for stickers. Whenever we go to Creative South, we come home with a massive sticker haul and we feel like kids again. But why do we have to wait another year for this feeling? Luckily, Slaptastic can give you that feeling each and every month, direct to your mailboxes. Each month, you'll receive a pack of 6 limited edition themed stickers that you can enjoy and share with your friends and family. Head on over to www.slaptastic.com/CS17 and sign up today with a special offer just for you. We've gone through and streamlined the Creative South Podcast Patreon page, cleaning out the excess and making it easier for you to support us. With options starting at just $1 per month, you can help support the podcast and even wind up with some cool Creative South Podcast swag. Every dollar helps cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. When you become a Creative South patron, you'll get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, Creative South podcast stickers and t-shirts. So, please help support the podcast and become a patron over at patreon.com/Creative South. All right. Brad, thanks for joining me tonight.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Thanks.
So walk me through, where'd you grow up?
I grew up mostly in suburban and rural Indiana, kind of suburban Indianapolis and rural Indiana. My dad was a pharmacist at a place called Hooks, which I think was eventually purchased by CVS. But they have this really interesting promotion strategy where if you do well, you know, you start at the very smallest town. If you do well, you go to the next smallest town and then the next smallest town. So I grew up in a lot of small towns.
Gotcha. So you kept moving up markets to bigger and better things, essentially.
Yeah, but I think when you think up market, it was like from 12,000 people to like 18,000 people.
I didn't say it was big up market.
No, market's a loose term.
Yes. So when you were growing up, were you, you know, what were you into? Were you into sports, art?
You know, if you grow up in rural Indiana, you kind of have to be into basketball. That's just kind of the thing.
It's required by law.
It's required by law. That's right. So I was legally bound to basketball. My parents were pretty into sports. So I did that. And I kind of played sports most of the way through high school. It was always kind of it wasn't always a perfect fit, I guess.
Sure.
So I don't know. I'm really thankful for it. And I thinking about doing it, you know, there are certain things I like. I'm glad I did, playing sports, but, I certainly was eager to stop doing them too.
I understand that well. So you get out of high school and what do you end up doing?
Yeah, when I was in when I was a senior, my dad took a job in Dallas, and so I finished out the year and I stayed with a friend for the summer, finished a job, and I went to a small school in Missouri. I hated it, and then I ended up moving down with them to Dallas. So this would have been when I was 18, 19. And ended up, just because I had no idea what to do, I worked for my uncle, had a moving company. So in the summers, I moved furniture, which you quickly learn that moving furniture in Dallas in the summer, you know, isn't something you want to do. You know, you just don't want to do it forever.
No, yeah. Living in the deep south, no way in hell.
Right. So I transferred to a community college down there, the Community College Network, and kind of started up. Like I said, I had no idea what I wanted to do. So, I ended up with I think when I graduated finally, I had 30 or 40 hours too many and no minor.
No minor.
So, I took lots of classes. Sure. And I ended up transferring to the University of North Texas, which is where I ended up.
Gotcha. And what did you study when you were in college?
I studied literature. That's what it, you know, I was about 3 hours, I think, away from a minor in French, a minor in photography. But I ended up, I think ever since I was, well, my parents say that even when I was little, they would find me in the bathroom, like sitting next to the toilet, reading a book, although I don't remember that admittedly. But I've always loved to read. And I think there was some point when I was 14 or 15 or 16, where, you know, kind of peak angst and in realizing that people like wrote interesting books that I could relate to was kind of this huge revelation.
Mm. So you're studying literature. How does that lead to the path of running an agency?
I don't know if it actually leads there at all. It happened.
I mean, I can see like a logical progression of, you know, you get out of school, you've been studying literature. So there's obviously a lot of large writing component that goes in with that.
Right.
You take a job as a copywriter, you move up, you decide, hey, you know, things like that. But was that your path or what did you do?
Yeah, I think someone's smart and that was oriented around planning would probably have done that. But yeah, I did kind of the opposite of that. So when I graduated, I kind of thought I would go back to school and do a PhD and become a professor. That's because I think mainly because I thought if you're interested in books, that was really the only thing that you could do.
Sure.
I didn't know anyone who was interested in the things that I was, who did anything other than that. And so I took, I decided to take a break. I got married and we moved mm-hmm. to Lexington, Kentucky, which is where a lot of my wife's family's from. And she was going to school here. And at the time I took a job at a bike shop and ended up managing the shop for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved selling bikes. I'm still really interested in bicycles. I had a lot of fun. It's really gratifying to like someone walks in the door, you help them find the right bike and you see them get really mm-hmm. excited about it. And then they kind of go on. So this is just like kind of quick turnover of really, this really gratifying kind of interchange. But professionally it was out at, I don't know, early 20s or mid 20s, I guess I was kind of maxed out. I didn't really want to own a bike shop. so there wasn't much to do. And so right along this same time, I was putting on this larger scale kind of citywide bicycling event. Mm-hmm. And I had met a friend who was doing a similar thing with music. He was putting kind of an underground music event on. And we both liked the event's stuff, but we kind of liked promotion of the events. And we had all these kind of commonalities. And we decided eventually, I think both of us kind of needed a job. It was the fall of 2008, which there was kind of a economic slump, you might say.
Right as the recession was hitting.
Right. And no one would hire us. so we started a company. And here we are almost 10 years later.
So when you started Bullhorn, what was your goal with it? Were you just, you know, looking to do like event planning? That's not the word I'm looking for.
Right.
Event promotion, things like that.
You know.
Or did you have goals at the time?
We did. Yeah, we had a few goals, which, you know, some turned out to be more achievable than others. I think right when we started it, there was a nonprofit here who sent us to a conference called Creative Cities in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And we heard some folks there who were talking. They had started companies. They were mainly doing publication stuff. And they were from kind of Rust Belt cities. There was someone from Detroit, Cleveland, I think Pittsburgh, and they were talking about how their cities were experiencing this really interesting time where there was this kind of dominant narrative of there's this Rust Belt city, everyone's leaving, it's dangerous, there's a lot of crime, urban decay. But they were talking about how that wasn't how they experienced their cities. And so they wanted part of their work to have to do with telling a different story to the broader community or the country, I guess. And so something about that really resonated, and we didn't know exactly how to do that. So if we had like kind of a lofty idea, I think somehow we wanted to change the way people thought about Kentucky, maybe Central Kentucky specifically. You know, you probably have similar experience. You know, people think about Kentucky,
having lived there throughout high school. Yeah.
You know, you don't think design. You don't think about, you know, this kind of like cultural capital.
Not at all.
We had a lot of work to do. So that was a goal, and we didn't know how we were going to get there. We just knew we would do just about anything. Mm-hmm. And we've done a lot of strange things along the way. For example, one story I tell is early on, this would have been the first spring. So spring of 2009, someone called us. There's an event here that's put on by the College of Design from the University of Kentucky. And every mm-hmm. spring they take over a warehouse space and create kind of like a rave atmosphere, and all the proceeds go to local nonprofits. And it's kind of this big party. And so they called and they're like, hey, you know, we've heard your name. Some friends of ours have heard of you. But, you know, we looked at your website. We still don't really get it. We don't know what you guys do. But our bar vendor backed out. Can you guys do that? So we're like, yeah, of course we can do that. So we get a U-Haul. And well, first off, we were like, okay, so there are like 3,000 people that's going to come in this 3-hour period, and all of them are going to want drinks. So we got to figure out how to like move people through. And so we're thinking, okay, who can do that? And so we go to Starbucks and watch kind of like how they move people down the line. And it's like, okay, I think we can do this. So like they'll walk in, they'll pay, we'll take the drink order. And so we rent tables, we rent this U-Haul, buy a bunch of booze, get a one-day liquor license, and hire a lot of our friends. Mm-hmm. And you know, we thought it was like kind of our first like real paying gig, and we thought we were rich. So you can kind of imagine us in the back of the U-Haul at 3 o'clock in the morning, pitch black, the doors locked so people don't break in and steal all of our money. We have on these like climbing headlamps, and we're counting all of these singles, just like fistfuls of filthy singles. Our hands are totally gray because it's the sort of party it is it's like, you know, it's more body paint than clothes. So people are pulling this money out of everywhere. So it's just disgusting and filthy, and it smelled like, you know, it smelled terrible. So
it smelled like BO and booze.
BO and booze. And yeah. Oh man. So we quickly realized, well, interesting, that's not exactly what we wanted to do.
Sure.
I don't know. Like over time, it started off like a lot of things. We kind of thought we would do general marketing work, and friends and family gave us a chance. And over time, we slowly stopped doing the things we either weren't good at or couldn't make money at. Mm-hmm. And we found this core offering of brand design. And it's something that we felt like, well, we think our work has a really big impact on the companies we work for. It's something we really enjoy and find gratifying. And it's something that right now, at least, people are willing to pay for. So
sure.
That's how we got here.
So how is it, walk me through the evolution of how you guys kind of discovered that you wanted to do the marketing and the branding side of it, because, you know, going from event promotions and, you know, basically bartending at a rave.
Yeah.
to what you do now is there's a huge gap there. Those are not two concurrently running businesses.
No. So we quickly realized that while we kind of liked events, and the thing we liked about events were that they can have such a big impact on a community. You think kind of like communities that have these keystone events, whether it's like Mardi Gras or something, make such a fingerprint on the culture that we were really interested in that. But we quickly realized that no one really wanted to pay us to do that.
Sure.
So it quickly kind of dropped off, and we started working for, we did about 50-50. Half the work we did was for nonprofits, and half was for mostly small businesses at the time. And, mm-hmm. you know, we would do a good job for somebody. They would recommend us to a friend. It was just referrals. And we really, we learned a lot along the way. We really didn't know what we were doing. And I think one big advantage we had in retrospect over other people is that we couldn't actually do any of the things we were selling. So we had to really quickly find talented, smart people to work with. And so right off the bat, we met a big network of freelancers. And so we kind of thought originally that, that's how the business would go. But for us, it ended up being a little bit easier logistically, at least back then, to have folks in-house. It just became such a bear to manage. And so I think that was one thing that was really helpful, is we got really good at delegating things and finding people who were smarter than us and better than us at the things we wanted to do. And I think if we did anything right, it was maybe a couple of things. I think we were nice, which goes a long way. When we screwed up, we would own it, and we hired smarter folks than us.
So, you know, through this process, you've got to learn how to do the job yourself, though.
Yeah.
What were the struggles that came with that?
I think I was always really kind of immersed in language. So, you know, I was really interested in novels, and I had written for lots of publications along the way. So I was pretty comfortable writing. So when it came to writing proposals or doing actual writing for clients, I felt pretty comfortable. The big thing that was the steepest learning curve was that neither of us had any business running a business. We didn't have any, we had no background, you know, we'd never done it before. I had never taken a business class. I think the highest math class I took was called college math. So I don't know to what degree college math prepared me, you know, to look at balance sheets. But I think that's been the biggest learning curve, and is actually more so figuring out how to run a business more so than figuring out how to do the work. I think just being around it, there's such a constant like bombardment of, you know, this new rebrand, you know, people are writing about it so much. It's so easy to kind of be constantly immersed in what people are doing in the kind of broader branding landscape. But for me, it was a little tougher to figure out how to run a branding business. And that's something that I'm still learning, but, we have some pretty big advantages. There's such easy access to information, and just, you know, just being able to download a business book to Audible and listen to it while I walk back and forth to work is a pretty huge asset, and you can learn quite a bit pretty quickly.
Gotcha. So, you know, obviously the business side of things is, you know, there's a lot of universal truths. Yeah. We'll go with that.
Right.
That go into you know, you got the balance sheet, you've got to do, you know, pro forma expenses and figure out, you know, what's, you know, project your costs and project revenue and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that across the board is fairly standard. But when you get into, you know, marketing communications and, you know, copywriting and design and all that, you know, what were the challenges for you personally that came with that?
You know, I think another big advantage is we didn't have any experience. And so we just didn't realize, you know, not having experience is sometimes bad, but on the other hand, we had no baggage. And so, you know, we thought, you know, anything could go. All people need to do is to figure out how to stand out a little. And so the work we did originally was, you know, some of the stuff was probably a little more aggressive even than what we do now. But I think learning out how to pitch work, how to sell work is a challenge that everyone has to figure out along the way. And I think that's one of the big things, the steepest learning curve, I think, is figuring out how to sell the work more than how to do the work.
Gotcha. What was your secret for figuring out how to sell things?
Well, I mean, my background selling bikes, I think, was pretty valuable, because you start to realize that it's not, if you're doing a good job, it's not about persuasion. It's about kind of finding the right fit. And so, you know, if someone comes in and I sell them a $10,000 bike, if it's not the bike that's going to be suitable to what they're doing, doesn't matter how nice it is, they're not going to like it. And so I think that was a big lesson that set me up to where I didn't have the pressure, I think, that a lot of people feel to be really like super charismatic and persuasive, but just to say, look, these are some of the goals that I hear you saying. I think this works for you. And it kind of takes a little bit of the subjectivity out of it. And so hopefully we were able to talk about things a little more objectively. And we just learned along the way and tried to do, throw out another cliche, we tried to do it. Better job each time.
Gotcha. So, one of the other things that comes with that is, since you're working with freelancers, you know, early on, and then eventually hiring people in.
Yeah.
You know, how did you develop a management style, or do you think you have a management style? Like,
yeah, I mean, that's another one of those things like leadership. People talk about, how did you learn, you know, all this about leadership, and it kind of seems like, I don't know. It mostly seems like BS. Management, not so much. I don't know. There's a really good book. I think the best thing I ever read about management, there's a thing called First Break All the Rules. And it's by a guy named Marcus something or other. I'd highly recommend that to someone who's in the position to manage people, creatives particularly, although this isn't at all about creatives. It's more about management in general. They accumulated this huge pool of data, and then they looked at across the board, from like restaurant owner to a tech person to, you know, a moving crew, what are the best managers doing? And they found some interesting insights. And I think one of the things that stuck with me is that when I'm talking to folks, I want to help people do more of what they're already good at. And I'm not really wasting my time helping them become good at what they're not any good at. Because it's just time consuming and mostly ineffective. So that was kind of the biggest insight from that. And as far as management style, I think that goes back to like the sort of person that I am, and really the culture, probably the culture that comes from the way we started, which is, we're very much, you know, if you're not a self-starter and you're not self-motivated, you're not going to do well here, because there's not going to be really anyone standing over you saying, you weren't here at 8 o'clock this morning, you know, where were you? So we're pretty loose in that sense, but we have really high expectations.
Gotcha. So, you know, your business has evolved into what it is now. You've gone through and, you know, figured out how to manage people. You figured out how to literally run the business side of it.
Yeah.
What now is kind of the most satisfying part of running an agency?
That's a great question. I would say the last 12 months, it's probably been really more, I've had more time to focus on the business side of things, which has been really gratifying. You know, when we started this, I always thought I would be writing funny ad copy or something, and I almost do none of that. I think still that same kind of culture of like figuring things out that kind of is pervasive here. You know, I'm really inspired by challenges and also by new things. And so there's another book we read together called Traction. And anyone out there who's running an agency, I would strongly recommend it. And there's actually a book that goes before it that's kind of a narrative that's maybe a better intro. We have started taking in some of those principles. And then also, I was lucky enough to become part of a peer group. And so, and the guys who are, or the folks who are in this peer group, are all in much larger companies. And so, hearing how they talk about their companies and the challenges, companies that are 25 years old, companies that are 30 years old, has been really inspirational and just like another, it's another one of those like huge, like learning leaps where I've really had to just to keep up and not look like an idiot. I've had to kind of, buckle down, I guess. So I think that's been the most exciting thing recently is really getting, tightening up our business processes. I think because we had, because of the work we do, our creative process was pretty well dialed in because we had done it so much. We kind of knew what worked and what didn't work. But, you know, if someone needed an insurance form or if someone wanted to know how many hours they worked last, you know, there's, that was like, it was a nightmare. It was the Wild West. No one knew anything. So like, I kind of realized at first I was like, that's just how it is. That's how we are. But really that's kind of, that's just an excuse and it makes it chaotic to work here and it made it not fun to work here. So, you know, we made some changes to bring that online. And then more recently, we're really taking our sustainability and kind of environmental impact more seriously and trying to figure out how to do a better job at that. So that's another exciting thing. And this on the creative side, this, I still really enjoy being involved in some of the language stuff. And like we had, for whatever reason, we normally have 3 or 4 language project or naming projects a year. And we've already had 3 this year. In the first 6 weeks of the year, we had 3 naming projects. So that's been pretty fun. And I've really enjoyed jumping into that and really digging in.
Gotcha. So walk me through, kind of explain the process of naming projects and how that works. I haven't had the pleasure of being involved with something like that.
Yeah. I think it's probably similar to how a lot of folks do. If you're a logo designer, it's the key thing is, so let's see, let me take a step back. I think the first thing is we listen to the clients, of course, sit down with them, get to know them. What do they want to do? What are their dreams? Is this a new company? Is it a successful company that's in a transition point for some reason? And then we really develop kind of a decision matrix for them. What are really the key criteria? What do they care about? And then we put together starting points, which are just blank spreadsheets. And there will be 2 or 3 of us usually working internally. And then we also try to hire someone externally. In this most recent one, there's a woman here who's a poet. And she's this, you know, this really great poet. And she had some downtime. And so we were able to hire her to help. And it was cool because she thinks about language in such a unique way, in such a different way than most people, and how you use it in these really interesting word pairings. And so what we do is we'll set the spreadsheet up in columns according to name types. So there'll be real words like Apple, Amazon. There'll be made up / foreign words. There'll be combined words
like the drug companies use.
Exactly, they tend to use or also there was, it's really funny, there's this, it's could be like 90s mid-sized sedan or like erectile dysfunction drug, and they all kind of like sound basically the same. They sound like vaguely like a fake Latin word. So this like Altima sort of thing. And then there'll be combination words like Facebook. There'll be misspellings like Flickr, affixed. There's a type of name called affixed, which we tend to steer away from because they sound dated quickly, like Spotify, Spotify, Shopify, Napster, those sorts of things that sound really internet-y. And then sometimes there will be additional categories like historical persons or places or whatever. And so we'll go through and we'll try to kind of put the criteria out of our mind a little bit and just think about them and what they do. And we try to get, I don't know, 200-ish feasible names down and try to call it down to 5 to 10 to present to the client. And a lot of them, they're pretty easy to dismiss out of hand. It's too obvious, or there's something that's similar that's better. So we can dismiss quite a few of them right away, and then we'll start to look at competition. And depending on what the organization wants to do, if it's a local wealth management company that's never going to work out of this region, it's a little bit easier because their only real competition is other local wealth managers, which is only about five other companies. If it's a fitness facility that wants to franchise nationally, then, you know, there are thousands and thousands of competitors. So thinking about kind of what they want to do business-wise also limits. And I think what we tend to do is kind of think metaphorically about what they want to do and try to head down and get, you know, think of something that, come up with something that works for them that kind of adds some meaning. I don't know. Those tend to be my preferences, at least. So that's kind of the general process.
How does language and, you know, how things are structured and, you know, that sort of stuff play into that?
I think so. If you think about language and meaning, that's kind of one of the key criteria we think about, and you can think of an easy example like Apple and how that transitions over time. So you think right initially, you know, they just start the company, they're hanging out in a bar and talking to someone who's like, "Oh, we just started this computer company." It's like, "What's it called?" "It's called Apple." And they're like, "Apples, you know, it's like the fruit, like you work in orchards or something." And so there's this initial kind of one-to-one thing. And then maybe a little bit down the track, a few people kind of buy into the idea and they start to think, "Oh, I get it. You're talking, this is a metaphor. You're talking about Isaac Newton, or you're talking about kind of Adam and Eve and this like thirst for knowledge." And then ultimately, if a product's as successful as Apple, they're kind of in an interesting space right now where they're kind of post name. Like you don't even think about, you know, it's just like the thing in your pocket. It's not even, you don't even really think about the name anymore or what it means. It's just a direct representative of the thing.
Yeah. Or like Google, where it's both a product and a verb now.
Yeah, exactly. And that can be good and bad.
Yeah, I can see that. So when you're going through, you know, and building names, how do you correlate that with a brand? How do you build a brand around a naming project and vice versa?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing we try to tell our clients is most of the naming projects we tend to get, because it's not a really strong startup community here, is we tend to get companies that are in transition for one reason or other, whether a new kind of core offering, or oftentimes they've been successful for 20 or 30 years. It was named after the founder, and now there's a new leadership group and they kind of want a cooler name so that they can attract talent. That kind of happens a lot.
Sure.
And so in that sense, we're not really trying to create a brand. We're trying to create a new name that is, a reference point for that brand. And so a lot of times names end up over time limiting the companies in one way or another. For example, there was a recent project. There was a local wealth management guy, and the company was called Boardman Financial. And it was John Boardman was the founder, and they wanted to grow. And one of the main ways they grow is by taking on new partners. And then these new partners have their books of business, and so they can grow fairly quickly. But they felt like having the founder's name kind of limited what they could do, because they wanted other people to come on as partners and really buy in. And so when we listened to them, we got this idea, like the sorts of guys that they are, the sort of folks they are, is they're not these kind of wheeler and dealers. They're really kind of, they take this almost like counselor sort of role, and they sit next to you. They talk through what your goals are for the next however many years. They talk through what's it going to take to get there. So they kind of take this like more advisor role, and over this idea of a journey kept coming up. And so we looked into all sorts of transportation words, looked through like freight through rail, steam, all of these different things. And so I was reading about ships, and the word ballast came up. And ballast is a current word, but in boating terminology, the ballast would be the counterweight at the bottom of the ship that provides stability for the journey. And so it came up to, it kind of hit as like, it's this great word that's like people kind of, it's familiar, but most people don't know exactly what it is. And so if they don't know what it is, it's just like, well, it's just this company. Or if they're interested, they look in and then they get it. And then it's kind of like, oh yeah, I get it. These guys are, you know, they're along for the ride. And so that's one example of how the name, it took away some of their limitations and gave them better business opportunities, I think, and worked practically. We try to take some of the pressure off of it because it's the hardest decision these people will ever make. And we kind of get a little bit immune to it because we do 20 to 30 rebrands a year and handful of renaming projects a year, but most of these people will only do one rebrand in their whole life or the whole career. And most of them will never change names. So I think the other thing is, like, when you step back and get some perspective, these companies have become really successful with really crappy names. And so that's the other part of it is, like, they're doing really well and their name totally sucks. So if you can help them take a couple of half steps, you can make a really big impact on the organization.
Sure. So, you know, when you're working with a company who, you know, like the financial planners that you know, where it's named after a partner, mm-hmm. and they know they want to move forward, and they know they want to explore that option. But there's obviously an emotional tie-in that comes with that as well, mm-hmm. because it is named after the partner. How do you get buy-in from those parties?
Yeah, if the whole group's not bought in.
Yeah.
If they're not, most of the time when people come to us, they've seen our work and they know that they're going to get something that's going to make them probably uncomfortable. And so most of the time, sure. people are a little leaned in to some pretty significant change by the time they get to us. It's pretty uncommon that it would be a surprise. So it's pretty rare that we have to try to persuade someone to change. You know, a lot of times we're just in the middle of a naming project for an IT company that was called DMD. And they were the owner's initials. But it also happens to stand for Doctor of Medical Dentistry. And so they get all these phone calls for like dentist, IT infrastructure. And they're like, yeah, we don't do that. But the funny thing is they've become this, I mean, they're one of the most well-run companies I think we've ever worked with. They're like a really amazing company. And there was, so the approach we've taken is because they have, I think, 8 stakeholders, 8 partners. And so there's a broad range of, there are some of the folks are ready to change. They want to change yesterday. And some of the people are like, man, we're making plenty of money. This is going fine. Let's not screw it up. And so we try to be honest about how it goes, because the reality is people are successful with bad names. That's what's kind of hard about, that's what's hard about naming. And the other tough thing about naming is that at some point in your life, everyone names something, whether it's a dog or a car or a child, you know, you usually at some point name something. So people have some experience and kind of think they can do it, where with the rest of the work we do, most of the people just can't physically make a logo. They just don't know how to manipulate the program to do it. And so we have a bit of an advantage there.
Despite what a lot of them think.
Despite what they think. Yeah. No. They do the ghost thing where they, you know, like where they kind of reach over the hand, and the ghost being like the movie, that is.
Yeah.
That's kind of a joke we have. You're getting ghosted.
I knew exactly what
the ghost design. let's see, what was the question? How do we get buy-in from people who aren't? We try to be as frank, as frank as possible and just lay out the options and say, look, you all know that this name isn't that good. You've been successful. And here's what we think. We think if you move forward with a new name, that it's the reality is that your current customers could care less. So they'll come along and be happy with whatever you're doing. And then new customers, as you move into different sectors, a better name will just give you a better opportunity with them. And I think usually people resonate with that sort of frankness. And again, it gets back to, we really try not to be overly persuasive or salesy, but just kind of showing them the cards. It's like, here are your options. You know, we know a lot about this and we think this is the best choice for you, but ultimately it's your company and you guys are doing great. If you want to keep doing what you're doing, you know, best of luck.
Gotcha. So when it comes to, you know, that frankness, what are some of the red flags that go up for you that it might not be the right fit?
I think if there are a couple, if there's like pretty wild disagreement within the group itself, that's usually a red flag that it's going to be a really difficult project. Another red flag is if the group we're dealing with doesn't always represent the final decision maker. That tends to be a red flag. If we don't have access to the final decision maker, say there's an owner of the company and we're working through a marketing or department or something.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like I said, it's like such a big decision for them that they have to really trust us. And until they're pretty bought in and leaned into the process, if they're not, we really kind of question and like, maybe this isn't a good fit for either of us. And there have been a couple of times where it's like, you know, this just doesn't seem like it's going to work out. It doesn't seem like it's actually what you all want to do. Sure. So maybe we should just tap the brakes and take some space and think about it.
Gotcha.
So I think if it takes a lot of persuading, like if we feel like we have to really push and put the sales pitch on, in general, that's a bad indication. You know, hopefully they're already really leaned in and like excited about the process.
So if you're having to do too much heavy lifting and carrying them through the process, then it's throwing up red flags for you.
Absolutely. Because it's so, all of what we do, the identity work that we do is high trust, but the naming part I think is especially so because it's so intimidating and because like, you know, companies in general tend to have more identity wrapped around their name than around their logo or their color or their website or things that we might end up doing. And also it's more common to change those things. The idea of changing your name is changing something pretty core to your identity. And as a person, not very many people change their name. And there are probably a lot of good reasons why that is.
Yeah. So, you know, I think you touched on it there. You know, the challenge, like you said, the challenge of changing the name can be a lot harder than changing the visual identity and things like that. When it comes to visual identity, what's your guys' process with that?
The visual identity process is probably fairly similar. We do an exploratory meeting together. We do a research and strategy meeting. In the research and strategy, we'll show them, we'll kind of analyze the stuff that they like and the stuff that they don't like just to help them see it through our eyes. And it's really an exercise to help us kind of settle on a common vocabulary so that when they're saying, you know, we're interested in something modern, that they kind of realize what we think might be something different. And so usually if we're going to do a name, we'll present the names at the end of the research and strategy because if not, the naming can seem really arbitrary. If you just throw like 8 pieces of paper with 8 words on it, they're just like, you know, what is this? These are just 8 words. This is totally meaningless. But if you go through the whole research and strategy, talking about how well we understand them, how well we understand the landscape, how well we understand the other organizations that their customers interact with, that sets us up for a pretty good position to authoritatively talk about what their company should be called. And the way we present the names, we've changed that, and we go back and forth a lot. So like what we do now is we'll go through and we'll pick a few background images and just type the word company in the middle, mm-hmm. and go through a series of images with company overlaid and show how the different images give you such a different feeling for what that word is. So even though it's the same word, when you see someone surfing and then you see someone standing in front of a tall building, and when you see this dramatically lit soccer field, it looks really different. And so we try to talk about context and how your name's never going to exist really just on a blank piece of paper, but it's always going to exist in some context. And then we'll go through the similar thing with the word company in a couple of different typefaces to show how imagery, typeface, color really affects the perception of how you see words. And that's usually pretty eye-opening to them. They're like, oh man, yeah, that's crazy. Because people just don't think about it. They just don't think about it. And then we'll pick a series of images and we'll overlay the names that we've picked, and we'll go through, and we'll usually do the name in a couple of different faces just to give them a range of what it might look like. Because at this point, we don't always have a strong feeling for their preferences. A lot of times we don't kind of understand them totally until the end of the research and strategy. So we try to present a pretty broad swath. And then after that, we go back. Hopefully they pick a name, and or if they don't change their name. We'll design a ton of stuff. We have 5 designers on staff right now, and we have a design intern as well. And it's similar to naming. Like, we're really strong believers in you have to make a ton of stuff to make something that's interesting. So, you know, we hope to throw away 10 or 20 or 30 times more things than we ever end up showing anyone. And it's the sessions can get kind of harsh because, you know, people get married to ideas and try to drill down on it. And sometimes they just don't work. And when we go to present the identity concepts, well, again, as you know, we try to present the identity stuff in context too. So we'll show some different colorways, some different images, and then here's the name and logo on a business card, and here's what it might look like on a t-shirt or on an advertisement. And at this time also, usually by this time, we've settled in on a few headlines and maybe a tagline for the organization. So starting to show some of that in context too of that concept presentation helps them get a fuller understanding of what the identity might be and how it would live. And so again, it roots it back to research so that it doesn't feel quite so arbitrary.
So, you know, you guys run through all these processes, and it sounds like you have similar structures throughout, mm-hmm. you know, no matter what it is, to keep it uniform. And you mentioned, you know, within the past 12 months, you kind of shifted things on your end of it with organizing how the actual business side of things run. How has the business as a whole changed, you know, now that you have those kind of formulas in place for the business side of things, and then you have new kind of formulas in place for the creative side of things?
Well, I think all of the push towards refining the business processes is all so that it all really is subservient to the work we want to do. I think if our business is more healthy and in a more sustainable position, it just sets us up to do better work. We get better clients and better timelines. We sign better contracts that give us more freedom. And so really all of it is kind of to that aim. And, you know, people ask like, oh, where do you see the agency in 10 years? And, you know, I don't really have a good idea. I just have the idea that we're on this kind of you know, evolutionary arc as an organization, and that my sense is that we haven't done our best work yet. And so we sometimes need to spend some time shoring up our business processes to ensure that we have the appropriate amount of time and resource to allocate to our creative processes so that we can all be fulfilled as humans and, you know, contribute appropriately to these clients and companies that we end up becoming pretty invested in.
Gotcha. So, you know, through the process of, it's been what, 8 years since you kind of, or eight or 9 years since you started?
Yeah.
Is there one, like, you know, white whale out there that you've always wanted to do work with, whether it be a client or a type of project that you haven't been able to break into yet? Or you're still wanting to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. Part of what we try to do is incorporate into our yearly planning is allow everyone who works here to throw out ideas of the companies that they've always wanted to work for. And
sure.
The cool thing is in some ways it's really cool when it actually happens, because it kind of, at the time, it seems like a pipe dream. It's like, oh yeah, everyone wants to work for Nike or whatever. But you know, last planning period, someone threw out the idea they really wanted to rebrand our transit authority here because their identity's not that good. They have really low word of mouth's terrible. But we felt really strongly that the service they provided was essential to the equity and to the vibrancy of our community. And so they ended up putting out an RFP. We put up some resources towards it, ended up winning the work. And we're really excited to be kind of going through this multiple year process with them of helping them rebrand and kind of rethink their organization and how they operate in an era where it's just as easy for someone to get, you know, an Uber or get a car share or a bike share or whatever. So, you know, in this new era of transportation. Anyway, so we're trying to help them think through some of these big questions that are kind of looming and facing them. And that's really exciting. And, you know, personally, I'm still pretty interested in the bike industry, and we've only done kind of a limited amount of work there. So I still would really like to do more work there, because just personally, I really like it.
Gotcha. So, you know, through all of this stuff, you know, what's been kind of the most rewarding thing of running your own business?
The most rewarding thing, that's a great question. Because there are definitely, I mean, there have been some times that have been very non-rewarding. You might say extraordinarily stressful.
Like learning what a balance sheet was?
No, that wasn't that bad. There was a period where we were doing a bunch of video work, and for several reasons, we kind of realized that it just wasn't going to scale very well, and it wasn't the exact right fit for us, but at the time made up 40% of our revenue. And so just kind of stopping doing that was a big decision, and we didn't want to fire anyone either. So there was someone that was leaving, and it was just kind of a natural break. And that whole summer and fall, where it was kind of like pay period to pay period, and I was just hoping a check would come in, it was super stressful.
Sure.
But I think the most rewarding, I had an experience just 2 weeks ago, and this is kind of a weird one, but there's a woman who works in our office whose mother died, and she was really young and was, got sick, and it was a sad situation. But we went to the service, and then it was important for us to be there. And then in addition, seeing people that were former Bullhorn employees flying in from all around the country to support this person in this time, like in this really sad kind of this sad time. I think that was for me the most meaningful thing that's happened so far. Just the idea that we created something to where people can be human, make human connections, and I don't know, can support each other. It's, I don't know. It was kind of, it's hard to talk about. I don't even know the best way to talk about it, but it seemed, sure, it seemed pretty important at the time. And in retrospect,
no, I can definitely see that, because you build a relationship with the people you work with, and seeing that carries over whether someone has left the company or not, and you know, that they're coming back to support those people that they worked with is, you know, I don't know the right word for it, but it's important.
Yeah, I felt like it just said a lot about the sort of people who we were attracting, it was one of those situations where it felt like we had made some of the decisions that we were unsure of. We did make a lot of good decisions. And so that was one of those moments I was pretty proud and felt happy that I was able to be part of this.
Gotcha. So, I think it's one of those things where it shows the type of culture you've built, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
You know, is that culture something that's important to y'all?
Yeah, actually. It's something that we've just been thinking through, and again, in the last few years, and kind of defining it and using some of the cultural elements, the kind of the core things about us, using that to make sure we're hiring the right people, making sure we're asking the right questions in interviews. You know, when there's a question about if someone's the right fit, we can use kind of our cultural guideposts as a way to determine that. And so, yeah, absolutely. I think the culture is, it's kind of everything, I guess.
Gotcha.
I mean, I think, because I think some people think about culture as what, not to get into a side discussion, but the idea of there are the distinction between what's kind of core to your culture and what are cultural byproducts, and things like, you know, beer in the fridge and fancy coffee and standing desks is kind of like, those are all kind of cultural byproducts. But
sure,
our culture is, you know, who we are and the sort of people that we attract. And it kind of becomes our shared mental map of how we navigate the world. And then also that it gets into the Tony Hsieh quote about culture and your brand being just opposite sides of the same coin. And so thinking about how like intimate your culture is with your kind of the brand that you put out and that other people interact with. So I think it's super important.
Gotcha. What's one thing that, you know, you would like to impart with people about the importance of your culture?
I think the most important thing is to articulate it in a way that's true. And I think if it's true, it should be useful. And so sitting down and just being really brutal when you start to say it, because like the first couple of things you write are usually all going to be, they're all going to sound like something else, and they're all going to be BS and taken from somebody else. And so it's probably going to take a little bit of time. And then once you've kind of articulated something, make sure you figure out how to use it, and, you know, build interview questions around it, set up, you know, criteria for exit interviews around it. And how do you do your weekly meetings based around your cultural things? And I also think it's probably important to put it out into the world so that I think you'll attract the right sort of clients if you can put that out in a way that's compelling, because you'll attract people who are more like you. And, you know, and also the most important thing is you'll probably dissuade people who aren't like you. And so, you know, it wasn't going to be probably a great working relationship anyway. And I can send along the link to ours if anyone's interested in reading what we've come up with.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Sure.
So, and we'll put that in the show notes at the end. So we're getting kind of close to our time here. You know, and we've talked about kind of moving forward of, you know, I don't want to say not knowing where you're going to be in 10 years,
because
that sounds negative, but not setting it in stone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but what does the next year look like for you guys, or what are you hoping to do within the next year?
Well, we hope to, we have some, We have some, you know, like any organization, we have some nuts and bolts, revenue targets, profitability targets that we want to hit just because we want to be responsible to the other people that are here. And we want to run a sustainable, strong business. Mm-hmm. I hope we had a ton of change last year. So I really hope this is kind of a year where we can just settle in and kind of run with what we've done. Last year we bought a building, we moved offices, we kind of rearticulated our values, we did quite a few business process changes. So this year I think it's really the year for us to stay the course and kind of push on things and see what we can do, see how it works.
Awesome. So where can people find you online?
You can find us at Bullhorn Creative. We're pretty active on the blog if you're interested. We're also on Twitter and Instagram at We Are Bullhorn. And you can email me at brad@bullhorncreative if you're interested.
Gotcha. Well, Brad, thank you for taking the time to chat with me tonight.
Yeah.
We end every podcast by saying go out and hug some necks, which is just kind of a way of saying go out and make friends, meet new people.
Right.
Would you mind taking us out by saying that?
Yeah, go out and hug some necks.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
You can find out more about Brad on Twitter at BullhornBrad, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at CreativeSOPod, and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CreativeSouthGA, over at CreativeSouth.com, and I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code CreativeSouth. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at Patreon.com/CreativeSouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.